Hey y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I was going to say it's at scotthorton.org, but it doesn't look to me like the site's working. Well, I don't know, the chat room is up. Hey, somebody in the chat room, say something. I sure can't get the page to load on my other computer anyway. I don't know. Anyway, hey! I got to start out every show with one kind of screw up or another, or else it ain't the Scott Horton Show. Anyway, Margley's going to be on the show, probably, to talk about Iraq. And I'm trying to get Josh Rogan from the Daily Beast on. He's got this great interview with Hashemi, the vice president of Iraq in exile. Phil Weiss is going to be here to talk about the madness going on in Israel right now. Deborah Sweet on the anti-Iraq war movement. Kevin Zeese on Edward Snowden and the Espionage Act. And plus, I got some complaining to do, too. So, doesn't that sound like a pretty good show? I don't know if I'm going to be able to get Rogan or not. I sent an email to what may be his email address. Oh, hey, look, this site came back. All right, good. Yeah, I don't know how to get a hold of Rogan anymore. My only email address that I had for him was foreignpolicy.com back when he was with them. Now he's at the Daily Beast. I don't know his damn email. Guess I could have called him. Have his phone number somewhere, don't I? Why didn't I think of that before? How did I get him on the show so many times before? That's what I don't understand. I've interviewed him a few times, but I don't seem to come up with much in the way of the emails here, man. For him. I don't know. Anybody knows how to get a hold of Josh Rogan from the Daily Beast? Put in the chat room. Thanks. You know, I wonder if, just have him in my contacts here somewhere. I might have saved him, right? I got a lot of J's in my contacts, that's for sure. Page down. Got quite a few Josh's here. Let me see. Josh Rogan. Nope. All right, well, crap. Anyway, Phil Weiss is going to be here. Deborah Sweet's going to be here. Kevin Zeese is going to be here. And probably Eric Margley is going to be here. So that's at least three good ones. And we can still talk about the Daily Beast piece by Josh Rogan, which is quite useful, I would say. The big news, of course, is Israel's ongoing war crimes in the Gaza Strip. Going after Hamas. At least 15 people killed already. That's what they're saying on Twitter. Step up their air assault. They've called up 40,000 reservists. And they say that they're preparing for a full-scale ground invasion. Although, I don't know if that's happened yet or not. I don't think it has. If only 15 have been killed so far, then sounds like the ground operation has not started yet. I should have the very latest from Google News up on Gaza right now. Israel steps up offensive with deadly Gaza bombings is the New York Times headline from 15 minutes ago. Israel bombs Gaza is the Guardian. That's quite a few hours old there. Anyway. Yeah, so it looks like they've not started any ground invasion yet. But they have called up as many as 40,000 reservists. So seems to be promising some bad news to come there. All right. Now, well, what the hell? What time do I got here? I'm going to play some Richard Pearl for you. Did you know that Richard Pearl did an interview about 3 weeks ago in Newsmax? This is the first I've heard of him in a long, long time. It's a guy named Steve Maltzberg interviewing Richard Pearl. I'm going to take some notes, and I'm going to have some comments when we get back from this break.
The subtle connotations. Does that bother you at all?
Well, it has connotations. I wouldn't say they're subtle.
I'm sorry. The question was, what about the word neocon? Doesn't that just mean that you're an anti-Semite if you ever say the word neocon? And then so Pearl is agreeing that, yes, of course.
It's Pat Buchanan. What can you say? He was opposed to going into Iraq. He misunderstood the reasons that some of us advocated it. We were not doing it to bring democracy to Iraq. We were not doing it, as he has sometimes suggested, on behalf of any other government. We believed the intelligence that was available at the time, that the CIA and other intelligence organizations with which we're allied in Germany, in France, in the UK, that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, and there was a danger after 9/11 that he would share those weapons. That was the only reason for going into Iraq. The idea that this was some sort of crusade on behalf of democracy is simply wrong. And after the failure to find the weapons of mass destruction that were believed to be there, people often, as a kind of rationalization, began to talk about the virtues of democracy. I agree about the virtues of democracy, but that was not the reason for going into Iraq. So for Pat Buchanan to claim that it was a mistake in 1983 seems to me to be rewriting the history.
And by the way, President Bush went to the UN twice, pleaded openly with Saddam Hussein to obey the resolutions. He defied so many resolutions, and a majority of Democrats and everyone in the House and Congress went along with it. So it is a kind of a revisionist history, I believe. But what connotation, I mean, do you believe there's any kind of, do you believe that that neocon is a code word of sorts?
Oh, yes, it's often used to describe Jewish Americans, because as it happens, some of the original thinkers whose ideas have now been characterized by this general term, neoconservative, were in fact Jewish. And it often carries conspiratorial tones on the part of people who throw the term around. The truth is that if you Google neoconservative and you read any number of randomly read articles about neoconservatives, you will discover that the neoconservatives themselves are almost never quoted. That is, they are not permitted to define their own views. Their views are being defined by their critics, and in some cases, quite hateful critics.
Do you believe Pat Buchanan fits that description as someone who throws it around and has uses that connotation purposely?
Yes, I do.
Okay,
and he's done this for a long time.
Okay, one more for you, sir. ISIS is moving the tanks and the Humvees that they seized, American tanks and Humvees, deserters left behind, American equipment, into Syria now. Not a surprise.
No, it's not a surprise. In fact, if you look at the mistaken American policies that have brought us to this situation, one of them is the way in which we departed in 2011. But the second and perhaps more important is the failure to recognize that if we stood by and did nothing in Syria, support would flow to the most radical elements.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. And so now we have a terrible situation in Syria. It has spilled over into Iraq. And the administration, astonishing as this may seem, is actually thinking about going to the Iranians.
I hope you're not dying from laughter. Hold still. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
To help.
Richard Pearl. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. We're in the middle of listening to this ridiculous interview of Richard Pearl on the Steve Maltzberg Show. I hope nobody laughed themselves unconscious or nobody split their side guffawing yet. Here, we're right at the part about how America should have supported the rebels in Syria more because that would have isolated ISIS somehow, that kind of thing. We're almost done, I promise. Very little more Richard Pearl to play before I come back with my straight setting.
Spilled over into Iraq, and the administration, astonishing as this may seem, is actually thinking about going to the Iranians to help deal with the situation that we allowed to develop and that the Iranians had been encouraging.
Sir, always great to talk to you. I look forward to the next time. Thank you so much.
All the best.
Thank you, Richard Pearl. Right.
All the best from Richard Pearl there. Okay, you can find this at Newsmax.com. Thanks to Ramsey Baroud for writing about this. Saw it on Twitter this morning. Boy, Richard Pearl, he's been hard to get a hold of. It's funny. He's been so missing in action that one might have even imagined that maybe he was a little bit, you know, chastened. Or is that the right term? I don't know. What do I know about vocabulary tests and stuff? But, you know, like maybe he realized he'd done anything wrong at all. Kind of, nah, come on, Richard Pearl? I mean, maybe he's tired of getting rotten eggs thrown in his head. But yeah, so let me count the ways here as quickly as I can now. All right, so first of all, I think it's important to note that he outright denies the idea that Israel or Israel's Ariel Sharon, the Israeli government's policy toward Iraq had anything whatsoever to do with the neoconservative movement's policy toward Iraq. The way he brought that up just to deny it, I mean, the host wasn't even really saying that. He just said, what about Pat Buchanan or, you know, that kind of thing. Had nothing to do with that whatsoever. At least he acknowledged the accusation that it had something to do with that. And then, did you notice what else he debunked there? That the American war in Iraq had anything to do with spreading democracy. He said, well, you know, a lot of people kind of unspecific, sort of, kind of, you know, emphasized that after they didn't find the weapons. In other words, he's saying the entire Bush administration lied through their teeth from the moment they invaded Iraq and said, weapons? Well, we might have mentioned weapons, but like we always said, the big goal here was to spread democracy throughout the Middle East. Yeah, because once the majority rules in Iraq, everything's going to be fine. And anyway, Richard Pearl just accused George Bush and all of his neoconservative friends and everyone in the media who ever repeated it and all the rest of it of all being a bunch of liars. Spreading democracy. Well, you know, we kind of made that up later. Wow. Okay, good. Thanks, Richard Pearl. I'll take your word for that, that you're a liar. Okay, good. Not about democracy. That was just hype. Okay, good. And he says, oh, that's just simply wrong. And then he says, what was the war about? It was that, no, we really believed the CIA. And we really thought that they had weapons of mass destruction and that there was a danger they would give them to terrorism, to terrorists. Just like we said in our excuse. That was it. Simple as that. And I think that's probably what his lawyer told him to say. That, like, no, really, I believe this. Nothing was a pretext for any other thing. Wolfowitz might say, well, we settled on WMD for bureaucratic reasons. It was the one thing that we could get everybody to agree on. It was doable. We did Iraq because it was doable, Wolfowitz said. Pearl says, nope, none of that. We thought, hey, he had these weapons and he would give them to Osama. And then he blames the CIA and other intelligence agencies. And before you think, ah, Office of Special Plans, Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group, where they're making up these lies in the Pentagon. He says, you know, like the French and the Germans and the, yeah, everybody who didn't want to invade over it, who sent their inspectors, who couldn't find anything. Jeez, the Americans keep giving us their best intelligence, and yet we can't find a single canister of nothing anywhere. Said the inspectors before the war. So Bush pulled them out and started the war anyway. Richard Pearl, it's in the New York Times, they did a whole thing on it. Richard Pearl went to England and met with a representative of Saddam Hussein. And the guy said, we will do anything. We will let in the FBI, the CIA, and the U.S. Army to look for weapons wherever you want. You want democracy? We will hold elections. You want our oil? We can negotiate over mineral rights. You want us to switch sides? This is Saddam Hussein talking. You want us to switch sides in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Fine. Just don't kill me, said his representative to Richard Pearl in London. And Richard Pearl replied, we'll tell Saddam we'll see you in Baghdad. And then he says, oh, if you use the word neocon, you just mean that you hate Jews and you're an anti-Semite. Well, that's funny because Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, referred to Douglas Feith and Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and their alliance inside the government as a separate government. He called the Office of Special Plans Feith's Gestapo office. And he was obviously referring to John Bolton, too. John Bolton's not Jewish. I don't think Stephen Hadley's Jewish. Maybe he is. But anyway, the neoconservative movement is not an exclusively Jewish movement. And so maybe some anti-Semite straw man somewhere uses the word neocon to mean Jew, but I don't even really know of any. Neocon has a specific definition. It's somebody who used to be a leftist who then became a right-winger, mostly because they put war first and Israel. Now, John Bolton isn't one because he is a natural born and raised Barry Goldwater right-winger. Not a neocon. Gets along great with the neocons because he likes war too. But that doesn't make him a neocon, it just makes him a conservative. Same for Dick Cheney, same for Donald Rumsfeld. They're just conservatives. Not because they're not Jewish, but because they've always been right-wing nationalists. The fact of the matter is, it's just a fact. Very few people in history in America have ever been communists except Jewish intellectuals in New York City, right? It's not like Trotskyism was a mass movement in America that you would have mass numbers of former Trotskyites turned Republicans. And yes, Israel is very important to neoconservatives in part because many of them are Jewish, and many of them, even like Paul Wolfowitz, is the descendant of survivors of the Holocaust. Obviously, they put the safety of the state of Israel as a high priority. No one's hiding that. Douglas Feist's law partner, Mark Zell, who I quoted on the show complaining about Chalabi the other day, his law firm is in a settlement in the West Bank. That's what he does, is he represents settlers in the occupied territories. Okay? Nobody is saying, nobody who, well, let me put it this way. 1,000 people who could never be construed as anti-Semites in a million years have noted the strong connections between the American neoconservative movement and the Likud party in Israel. That's just true. It's Richard Pearl's signature on the clean break strategy written for Netanyahu in 96 along with Feith and Wormser. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Oh, that's cool. Just in, Omar Khadr is being sent from Canadian federal prison to a provincial jail. Or I guess presumably he'll be treated a bit better. Young kid that was tortured by Americans into pleading guilty to things that weren't even war crimes anyway. Anyway. You don't want the truth. Direct quote from him. Title of the documentary all about him, if you ever get a chance. You don't want the truth. I think you can get it off the Pirate Bay or wherever you want. All right, our first guest on the show today is our friend Philip Weiss from MondoWeiss.net. MondoWeiss.net, the war of ideas in the Middle East. And he's got a great stable of writers over there besides his own self, including Alex Kane and Max Blumenthal and others. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
Great, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us today. I was hoping you could help fill us in on all the bad news. I guess the latest that I heard was the Israeli government called up the reserves and they were preparing to invade Gaza with a land invasion force. Is that correct? Has that already happened yet? Do you know?
Well, it certainly hasn't happened yet. There are reports that that's in the offing. I don't know. I don't know how accurate they are. I mean, certainly Israel has launched an assault on Gaza in recent days by air, and I guess there are reports that 10 to 12,000 reservists have been called up. So, and they've Israeli officials have said that they might be doing this. So, but it hasn't begun yet.
And then. Well, I don't know. It would just be a punitive thing, or it would be, are they saying that this would be their attempt to finally go in there and destroy Hamas once and for all, like last time?
I think it's the latter. I mean, it's just, you know, Groundhog Day in, you know, but of a genocidal or a murderous version, Groundhog Day. Yeah, yeah, we're going to finally wipe out the sources of these rockets yet again, and, they just don't have an answer, except, you know, war after war after war, which is, I think, beginning to be more and more obvious to people in America.
Right. Well, and the thing of it is, of course, is that these rockets, quote unquote, they come with ironic quotes. These are homemade devices. I mean, they can be deadly, don't get me wrong, but they're not deadly very often. They're basically, even under siege, Palestinian kids with kitchen cabinets can put together rockets like this. They'll always will be able to.
That's true. Although, I mean, I think that they have some fairly sophisticated devices that, you know, wherever they're coming from, have a little bit more range and greater accuracy. But
okay,
yeah.
So maybe they need a garage, not just a kitchen, but still.
Yeah, yes, 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 yes. Well, I mean, I think that what you're getting at is that there has to be a political solution of this.
Right,
you're
yeah, exactly, because you can't smash the source of rockets when the source of rockets is your bad policy rather than a specific garage on a block somewhere.
Right, and again, 80% of their population is refugees. These people were kicked out of Israel and prevented from returning. So what are you going to do with that type of grievance? You can't just continue to fire missiles at them. That is a kind of a profound foundational grievance about how you're constructing your state. You've got to deal with that with some type of political solution.
All right, now, going door to door and just harassing the hell out of the people of the West Bank, pretending that they're looking for these three kidnapped and later turned up dead Israeli teenagers, all that. That is just, you know, forget about it. There's I don't know what it says in some ancient Bible or whatever, but by no means in modern day civilization is that acceptable whatsoever, that kind of collective punishment, not with our modern theories of
individualism. I agree with you.
But what about Hamas? Hamas, they're a government, and they're responsible to some degree for this, that, and the other thing, including perhaps people who are not members of Hamas but are shooting rockets or maybe parts of Hamas. I guess somebody said a Hamas break-off group had been behind the kidnapping or something. Is it ever okay to bomb Hamas? To what degree are they responsible, and to what degree is it okay to ever bomb them, Phil, do you think?
Well, I don't think it is legitimate to bomb them for the attack on the kidnapping of the teens in the West Bank. That was a splinter group. It's a rogue group that doesn't approve of Hamas's more conciliatory methods. And, you know, you can't blame Hamas for that. And Israel's efforts to blame Hamas, Israel's motivation to blame Hamas is simple. They don't like the fact that the Palestinians have a unified government. They want a divided population. They want infighting among their enemies. That is what they've always wanted. They want infighting among Arab states. And that's happening, obviously, not only at Israel's behest, but, you know, the Israel certainly hasn't helped there. And they want the Palestinians to be fighting among themselves. When the Palestinians announce a unified government, that's bad news for Israel.
Right.
So they're using that teen, the killing, the horrifying killing of these three teens, they're using that as a an excuse for a political operation to try to divide Hamas from the from Fatah and divide the Palestinian population in a violent manner.
Right. Now, let me ask
manage
you this.
Conflict.
Is it important, Phil, how obvious that is? That they're saying, oh, goody, some kids got kidnapped? Let's lie our asses off and use it as a Reichstag fire. Whoopee, everyone.
Well, it's obvious to you, and it's obvious to me. And my question, my answer to you is, how obvious it is it to the American press generally or the American people? I'm waiting for the learning curve. Seems to be kind of slow here, but yeah, nonetheless, it's happening. And I think that we can celebrate some of the progress that's being made.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we've talked about before, and I may be more cynical than you about this, Phil, but you know, it's my basic belief that my understanding is that the American people have no understanding of this. That, in fact, I'll give you a perfect example of what I believe is the cookie cutter typical conception, and that was in Rand Paul's lies in the National Review, where he pretended that the Palestinians are quote unquote neighbors of the Israelis, as though they're Jordan, they're the country next door, not the occupied territory. And I think that that is the way that most people understand it, is that it's some kind of like World War One type fight over the line and where the line should be. And both sides claim God gave the land to them, so they're just going to fight forever and ever and ever and whatever. And it takes the whole, the reality of the who's occupying who and all the very, you know, earthly political things going on here get completely obscured by the fantasy of the narrative and mixed with all the religiosity and the rest of that.
They're, I think,
neighbors,
you're right.
Rand Paul says.
I think you're right, but, you know, here is one. You know, I think I'm more of a libertarian in this sense, that classically, that in the old days when people said the government was responsible for everybody smoking and you know, the public health organizations were responsible. I said, well, people are choosing to smoke. They have the information. And, you know, I used to make that argument. And but as a big government guy, I say, you know what? And big media, these attitudes can change when big institutions change. Mm-hmm. And similarly, in this case, the information is out there. Americans could inform themselves about the reality that it's not neighbors, that it's not a cycle of violence, that it's an occupation, and they just don't choose to inform themselves. Well, actually, I blame the media, and I blame Rand Paul less than I blame the media. They are the people who are supposed to, the lifeblood of a democracy is good information, and we are getting bad information here. Mm-hmm. And that is the one hopeful view I have of this matter right now, is that the media are changing.
All right, now hold it right there. I'm sorry. I'm going to let you elaborate on that point and others too when we get back. It's great. The great Phil Weiss, everybody, from MondoWeiss.net. Just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Phil Weiss from MondoWeiss.net, which I hope you read all the time. And we're talking about, the crisis in Israel and the crisis in America over the crisis in Israel, which, as Phil was emphasizing before the break, is really a crisis of the media. But then you were going to say before the break interrupted, Phil, something about the indications that you're seeing that the media finally is getting a little bit smarter about this.
Right. I mean, I think that we just have to acknowledge that the failure of the John Kerry peace plan, peace effort, he couldn't even get a GD framework out of this thing. All he wanted was a framework that would lead the way, you know, sort of a roadmap, not even roadmap. You know, and he spent 9 months going back and forth and couldn't do that, and it failed. Okay, and it failed in a giant way, and chiefly because of Israel's rejectionism. The mainstream media have accepted the two-state paradigm, that they've always said everyone knows the solution. They've said this again and again for many years. Well, if everyone knows the solution, then why is this a failure? And I think that even the mainstream media, which to some degree are attached to the existence of a Jewish state in Israel, have signed on to that definition and as sort of the world's answer to this problem. Even the mainstream media is understanding this is a loser, or something is just wrong with this, and this thing just failed. This has real consequences. You know, epistemologically or whatever you're going to call it, or intellectually or discursively. And I think that for many reporters now who are not attached to Zionism particularly, and there are mainstream reporters who aren't attached to Zionism, they're saying, what the heck is going on here? And Israel's only answer to this is violence. And we've, you know, there's been such a smorgasbord of violence in the last 10 years of all varieties, that I think the media are getting a little sick of it. And I'm beginning, so lately there has been much more coverage of Israeli violence in a critical fashion. That's changing. And I think that if Israel were to invade Gaza, you know, 5 years after, 6 years after it invaded Gaza the last time to stop the rockets and destroyed everything that people had, you know, these people are living under a medieval siege. The blockade there has a medieval quality. I think the American media might really begin to change. And that goes back to your point that Americans don't know. They could know. It wouldn't take long for them to know. And I think that some of this, the language is changing in important ways.
Right. Yeah, I think it's okay, especially with responsibility. You know, we often use numbers to assign responsibility, but I'm a little more flexible than that. I can put all the responsibility on the liars and the liars by omission in media and on the American people who are too damn lazy and uncaring to go look it up for themselves, because MondoWeiss.net has been sitting there, and so's antiwar.com, and so's Electronic Intifada, and a million other places where people can go to learn about this if they care to.
So. But Scott, those folks get a lot of traffic. I mean, I'm a glass half full guy. Let me be clear. I'm a progressive, so I believe in glass half full. I think that humanity is stepping forward every day towards a brighter future. Now I'm being a little ironic there, but don't you see some progress in American understanding on this?
Yeah, it's okay. There. I mean, and again, it's just the very existence of the internet and the truth. And the truth be told, you know, people's eyes get open. I mean,
I'm sure you have been surprised, as I have, by ordinary people, quote-unquote ordinary people's expressions of impatience and rage at Israel on comment boards, on bumper stickers, right, in public forums. At the Democratic Convention, when they shoved that Jerusalem will always be undivided. You know, there was a floor demonstration. Jeez, when was the last time there was a floor demonstration at the Democratic Convention? So,
and, you know, in the media, the changeover, I think, was kind of illustrated this week on CNN, where they had remarked on this tweet that men in Israeli police uniforms, because they were Israeli police, beat the living crap out of an American citizen on the West Bank as he's handcuffed and helpless on the ground. And then all of the responses to the tweet, of course, were mocking them for trying to pretend like it was questionable or not whether these were actually Israeli police. But then on the other side of that, Jake Tapper, as I'm sure you've seen, gave a pretty substantial grilling to one Israeli flunky, you know, functionary or another. And
yeah,
really, you know, grilled him. Hey, man, you know, all your critics say that what you did to this American is what you do to all Palestinians every day. And he was like, what? Nobody ever said that to me on TV before.
Wasn't that
before,
great?
You know?
It's great. Hats off to Tapper, you know. I mean, I think he knows the story. And, again, I put him in the category of a lot of journalists who have gone along with a paradigm because that's the solution that they've been given. And now they see a lot of problems with it, and they have to be responsible. I mean, I'm not as cynical as you are. I've got my cynicism, but I think there is a certain amount of intellectual responsibility they feel to tell people, hey, well, this thing might be falling apart, you know?
Yeah. Well, and it is. I mean, and to get back to what's mostly missing here in media that finally is starting to change in a positive way is a real crisis. Can you tell us more about what's going on the ground there now? Or in the last few weeks and leading up to today?
I think that, you know, what we've seen is a real uptick in violence in the last few weeks, to the point that even Brian Williams on NBC is talking about a possible intifada. I mean, far be it from an American to tell Palestinians whether they're having an intifada, but there's been a lot of a lot more resistance on the West Bank. There have been Israeli raids across the West Bank. Hebron, the largest city, has been locked down again and again, and freedom of movement has been restricted across the West Bank even more than it usually is. So I think that we're and there's a sense of panic on the part of Israeli leaders by the reunification of Fatah and Hamas, the political factions of the Palestinian society, and the breakdown of the two-state paradigm. The increasing criticism of Israel in international forums, the growth of BDS, the boycott movement, all these things are making Israel a more panicked and, I think, a violent actor. And so I think, I mean, there are crises there all the time. I don't know if what level of on the Richter scale we're headed for, but I think this could be a landmark year in terms of the understanding of Palestinian resistance worldwide. And Israel would like nothing more than for that resistance to be violent, because it has an answer to violent resistance. And yet the world community has been, a lot of progressives have increasingly been supporting this nonviolent movement of resistance, which is boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So the short answer, I'm sorry I gave you such a long-winded answer, we're headed toward a South Africa struggle for equal rights. That's what we're beginning to see is, here's this oppressed population. They want equal rights. What are you going to do about it?
Right. Well, can you give us an update on the BDS and how big of a movement that is? And can you give us any kind of ballpark in, you know, billions of dollars lost in business and how it's working?
I don't know the numbers. I know that it's working symbolically very effectively. I mean, the Presbyterian Church, while saying we have nothing to do with BDS, divested from three companies that were involved in the occupation last month in a landmark vote. It had repeatedly shut down this divestment effort by narrow votes. Well, this time it approved it, and there were real shades of South Africa here. They voted to divest from South Africa 25-30 years ago. So I think BDS is having really big symbolic victories, and it's making the Israelis sweat. I think, again, it's the South Africa analogy that is really beginning to gain traction.
Yeah, but where's the de Klerk in this one?
It's a good question.
There probably are a few Mandelas. I don't know who, but I don't know who's the de Klerk. I mean, the nicest, the kindest person in Israeli politics on this issue is, what's-her-name from Kadima, who's horrible, right?
I agree with you, but, you know, that you're absolutely right. And who has licensed this kind of right-wing extremism? The United States by saying, you're right, you're right, you're right. Well, when that starts to change, I think we could see a de Klerk in a few years. I mean, again, glass half full, but, I mean, the other part of this, just by the way, is there's no green line anymore. This whole idea of a West Bank separate from Israel, that's been destroyed by this crisis in the last few weeks. Israel's all over there. It's clear they have complete sovereignty over these territories. They go where they please. And so, you know, we're seeing one state. This is effectively one state with these little Bantustans where they force the Palestinians into.
All right, we got to take this break. I want to keep recording you for just a minute, but we'll be right back, everybody, with Deborah Sweet in just a minute. But if it's okay, Phil, I want to ask you a little bit more about that. There's been talk in Israeli politics lately about going ahead and outright annexing the West Bank, and forget de facto, let's just go ahead and call it the province of Sumeria or whatever it is. And then I guess it was Livni, right, who threatened to walk out, is that right, to destroy the coalition if they did it? But I guess what you're telling me is it's only a matter of time now and not much time before it's just kind of recognized broadly that the West Bank has been annexed already.
I think it de facto is annexed. I mean, we're talking about de facto one country. I think the official de jure recognition, though, is not going to happen for a while, particularly because of the pressures. And, I mean, what the United States would do if they did that, I think there would actually be some pressure from the United States. But de facto, yeah, that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with one country. Yeah. And, yeah.
Well, in that sense, it really has been since 67, since they never meant to give up any of it. And it's always just been a ruse, this peace process, this whole time, just for keeping it anyway. So why?
It certainly looks that way.
Yeah, so, certainly in practice it's played out that way anyway. But so then here's my only thing about that. Of course, I would rather have a no-state solution, or at least the most limited state possible, you know, just your local kind of, you know, peace deputy walking around on the night watchman state. That way there's very little to fight about, and so identity politics don't have to play that much of a role, because who cares who's in charge of the very, very, very limited government, that kind of thing. But what I'm looking at in the real world I live in is that if it's really a one state thing and the Palestinians are a majority, then they're, you know, basically the Israelis have to decide, or, you know, somehow by international pressure, they're forced to choose democracy over Jewishness of the state, then there'll be another massive Nakba, and they'll just massacre everybody or drive them into the Jordan River or something, and make sure to keep the demographic majority even inside the new greater Israel, which would be, you know, an absolute, horrible humanitarian catastrophe. So it's sort of just from like, and it's, I don't even have a dog in the fight, but just looking at it as an observer, it sort of seems like, you know, probably just never mind morality about what, you know, the perfect or the good or whatever, but just what solution would be less likely to see the Palestinians just outright butchered by the Israelis would probably be a two-state solution rather than a one-state one.
I love what you're saying, because there's so much overlap between you and Noam Chomsky here. It's really funny.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, Chomsky wants a no-state solution, and Chomsky says the existing solution, if it's a one-state solution, is basically ethnic cleansing, and just worse than apartheid, worse than anything we've... So that's why he's for a two-state solution. So you're sort of saying the same thing. Isn't partition and limited Palestinian sovereign, or, you know, Palestinian sovereignty on half the land, isn't that better than them being ethnically cleansed? Because the Israelis won't.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I would have the Israeli parliament abide by a very limited rule of law and then let all the Palestinians vote for members of it. Again, if it's that limited in its power, let everybody have a one state and equal rights and all that.
I mean,
you know, it's not like I'm saying... Oh, we got to appease the KKK in the South so that they don't do even worse or something like that. You know, I'm not taking that side, but I'm just saying, realistically speaking, boy, who's going to stop the Jewish KKK from cleansing the West Bank of Palestinian Muslims and Christians?
You know, and that's where I go to my identity politics, and I say that... you're right that that has been licensed by the United States again and again, but look at the Jewish community in the United States. I think it's changing enough that they may actually say, this is crazy. And similarly, the politicos in the United States might begin to say, this is crazy. That's why I'm glass half full, that a de Klerk could emerge, that the international pressure is transforming the politics of this, and Israel's... aggression on the West Bank is actually a symptom of the greater and greater pressure they're facing.
Right. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I've already kept you way over time.
No worries,
man. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thanks. It's always great talking to you, Scott.
Great to talk to you, too. That's Phil Weiss, everybody. The great Phil Weiss from MondoWeiss.net. And he's been a great journalist for a great many years and for the last quite a few on Israel-Palestine pretty much exclusively. He's got a great stable of writers over there, Horowitz, Roth, and Blumenthal, and et cetera. And we'll be right back with Deborah Sweet in just a minute. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Ah, hell. I guess I do want Rand Paul to get the Republican nomination, if only to see all the neocons flock to Hillary Clinton with their leader, Robert Kagan. Ah, ha, ha, American politics. All right, anyway. Guess what? We got Deborah Sweet on the phone, our old friend from World Can't Wait. Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Hey, Scott. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. Very happy to have you back on the show. I got a big question for you. With the background being, of course, the escalation back into Iraq, what are we doing about it?
Well, you know, not enough. That's a very simple answer. And part of it starts with what do people think is going on? I can't tell you how many people are stuck on this thing of, oh, it was Bush's war. Obama tried to get us out, but it was Bush's war. It was a big mistake. There's a lot of strange thinking going on around if you look back at what was actually happening in 2003. And I think we got to come to grips with that. And in the meantime, yes, we really need visible mass resistance. World Can't Wait has called for responses when the U.S. starts bombing. And, of course, that's a little bit tricky because they've got those drones and helicopters and a lot of special forces in Iraq right now. So we don't exactly have the situation in 2003 where there was one moment of shock and awe when everything in March of 2003 kicked off and the U.S. was in there. Nevertheless, it's really important for people to be following the situation, and open U.S. involvement in Iraq has absolutely got to be protested.
And now here's the thing of it, too. We saw last summer that the American people, when the Pentagon agrees with them, can stop a war. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's at least, in the case of Syria, of course, it seems like there's at least part of the military that is resisting this. Somebody is agreeing, you know, there are more than one person in the Oval Office meetings is saying, hey, let's go slow here a little bit. And you're right. I mean, when they do start bombing, it'll be secret and it'll be a slow escalation. It won't be a shock and awe. It'll be harder to really galvanize people around in that sense. But it seems like there's a reason they're going slow, and it's because, imagine this, even American foreign policy makers are up against the reality that all that they can do is make matters worse and get America in worse and worse trouble over there. So whoever it is, even if there's just two people on the National Security Council or something somewhere, anyone inside the government who's making that kind of case that, geez, boss, I think maybe we ought to stay out, those people need people on the outside supporting them and reinforcing that, because it's got, you know, that was what stopped the war in Syria last time, was dissent on the inside, and along with, boy, and look at the polls, guys. And not just the polls, but people were adamant about it. People were like, hell no, don't bomb Syria last summer. And if we can recreate that even partially, we might could stop this before that first day of bombing.
Well, we need people feeling as they did last August and September that it's completely illegitimate and wrong for the U.S. to go in and bomb another country. And we have some things to overcome in Iraq. I think you're pointing out a basic difference, not strategically, but tactically, between the Obama administration and the Bush regime. Thinking back about 2001 and 2, you had Donald Rumsfeld salivating over the idea of invading Iraq. Cheney and Wolfowitz, all these guys, you know, they delude maybe a lot of people, but they also may have deluded themselves about how easy it was going to be to go through Iraq. And then after their real target, which at that point and maybe still is, was Iran. And it didn't work out very well for them. Really, they got deeply bogged down, taking a country that was a sectarian, i.e. not religious country, with a vicious tyrant at the top, and turning it into a secular religious country with a vicious tyrant at the top, who happened to be beholden to the U.S. instead of beholden to Russia and the former Soviet Union. And that's a big difference. So now, yeah, I think the Obama administration is saying, whoa, who's the friends and allies here? We have a really big mess that this administration has created. Remember, Obama wanted to leave, he wanted to withdraw from Iraq in a certain way, but he wanted to leave at least 10,000, maybe more, troops in Iraq, and Maliki wouldn't let him do it. Why? Because Obama would not sign an agreement that U.S. troops would be subject to Iraqi law. In other words, when they went around shooting and killing civilians, they were going to have to go into an Iraqi court. Obama wouldn't agree to that, and he withdrew everybody. And I think most people looking at the situation knew it was just a matter of time before something like this happened. Of course, we couldn't have predicted the Arab Spring in 2011, or even, you know, the major economic worldwide recession in 2008, and the drought that went across that region. There was a lot of unpredictable factors. The only predictable factor is the U.S. is going to do what a majority of people at the top of the ruling class decide is in their interest, and it's never, ever going to be in our interest, nor certainly in the interest of the people of Iraq or Syria, which is kind of the point we try to bring out.
What's funny, Deborah, it was last summer, it's Obama in power. So the way the right wing looks at him is, you know, sure, we're all for killing people, but we don't trust this SOB to be the commander in chief. So that's good. We can work with that. And then also, there's such cynical, racist, bigot, pro-war murderer types that they detest the Syrians. And so when the spin for the war is we have to go help the Syrians, the conservatives' answer is we don't want to help the Syrians. Let them burn. Let's withhold our fire. So that, because we don't care what happens to them, even though, of course, the war would make everything much more horrible, but that's their attitude. But okay, fine, right? If that's the attitude that we have to harness, that the Iraqis aren't worth helping anymore because of how ungrateful they are or whatever, fine. If that's what conservatives have to hear, then, you know, let's go ahead and harness that, and we'll get that realignment for, the leave those poor people alone, and the, you know, leave those sorry bastards alone caucus, you know, and put a stop to the war before it's too late. Because, of course, what it means in real life is once the drones start firing, then that means Obama's putting all 300 million of us up on the target list for the next Al-Qaeda kooks who want to come back to the United States here?
Well, I think what we have to go to the people in this country and everywhere with is the actual truth. What happened the last 23 years of U.S. involvement in Iraq? 1991. They went in and they thought they had cleaned up a problem with Saddam Hussein. Well, they didn't. And then there was 12 to 15 years of sanctions under the Clinton administration, which ended up killing a lot of civilians, really weakening the country. But the people who paid the price were the children and the women. And that's true in all of these imperialist wars. Then along comes the opportunity of 9/11, the Bush regime saying, let's go massive. This was the quote from Donald Rumsfeld, go massive, sweep it all up.
I'm sorry. You know, we're so short on time. Let me just ask you real quick. What about picking a Saturday real soon here, getting with as many groups as you can and holding as big a protest as you can put together, maybe in a week from now, instead of waiting until the first bombs fall, see if it's possible to try to recreate that March 15th, 2003 effect here and try to head it off. Is it just impossible, Deborah?
Well, you know, we have had a series of protests already in June, and I never say anything's impossible, and I like your spirit. And as soon as we feel that there's it's a potential to get a critical mass, we have to keep looking at what's going on over there. And also in Israel right now, there are going to be major protests today and tomorrow against Israel around the country. But people can find out about whatever's happening at worldcan'twait.net.
Great. All right. Well, listen, I sure appreciate your efforts, and I encourage you to do as much outside as you can, especially knowing, you know, you're there in the Capitol, way out here in the hinterland. I wish I could go outside with a sign where anybody could see it. Not that it makes that much difference, but when there's a lot of them, it can make a difference.
It does make a difference.
That with Syria last summer. It can be done.
Yeah, we got to get to the people. Challenge them to think about what their government's doing. Thanks, Scott.
All right, everybody. That's Deborah Sweet from World Can't Wait. They're on Twitter at World Can't Wait, and they're online at worldcantwait.net. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. So, I saw a thing about, it was in McClatchy Newspapers. Had a thing about all the right-wingers talking about impeaching Barack Obama. Now, of course, I'm for impeaching Barack Obama. I've been for impeaching Barack Obama since January the 20th, 2009. I'm for impeaching and removing the presidency entirely. And I'm certainly for the impeachment, the removal, the prosecution of anyone who dares to be the president of the United States. That'll teach them bastards. Lock them all in prison for the rest of their lives. And then see who wants to run for president. I am against presidents. There should not be presidents. Anyway, that's my position. But then I read these right-wingers' complaints about Obama, and really all they got is Benghazi and what was the other thing? Something just as stupid. Are you kidding me? Barack Obama, who we got two credible witnesses at the highest levels of government who can testify that Obama knew and said that he knew that the surge could not work, but who then doubled down the Afghan war, quadrupled the Afghan war for 3 years when he knew it would not work, sacrificed thousands and thousands of lives, including hundreds and hundreds of Americans. It was 2010 and 2011 were the worst years of American casualties in the entire war over there, and he knew that it wasn't going to work. According to the Washington Post, credibly, and they never denied this, There was a CIA report that said, don't bother, Mr. President, the surge ain't gonna work. And he knew it said that because he'd been told, and so he deliberately did not read the CIA report. Remember all the conflict about, oh, he's dithering. Yeah, he's dithering because he knew that it wasn't going to work. But then what did he do? He went ahead and quadrupled down the war anyway. Why politics? If he ends two wars, he might lose seats in the midterm elections, you know? So he murdered thousands of people. Meanwhile, if he'd just been honest, he could have ridiculed David Petraeus right out of the media. Surge worked. Let me tell you about David Petraeus, all right? He could have destroyed Petraeus with two sentences. Boy, Iraq, they're just waiting for the Civil War to break back out again. Just mark my words. And we're going to use that as the basis for doing the same thing again in Afghanistan? Forget it. But nope, he quadrupled down. Hired Petraeus and Petraeus' torturer man, McChrystal, from Camp Nama to go and replicate the same horror on the people of Afghanistan to no end, to no good end whatsoever. Surge is over. What'd they accomplish? Nothing. Did they build a government in a box in Marja? Nope. They changed the entire society in Kandahar? Uh-uh. Just killed thousands of people for nothing. For nothing. And then, of course, the murder in Somalia, the murder in Yemen, including of American citizens, three of them, including a 16-year-old boy, over the most bogus, pretended Department of Justice interpretations of the law. In fact, the best take on this I've seen so far is Peter Van Buren at We Meant Well, talking about the drone assassination of American citizens memo. And how absolutely ridiculous it is. What low quality its arguments are, etc. And then starting a war in Libya in complete and total violation, in fact, contempt of the War Powers Act. And how about just we remove Obama from office, impeach and remove him and prosecute him for his torture, not only of Somalis and Afghans, but how about of the English language? Isn't he guilty of the felony of pretending that espionage means leaking to the Washington Post and pretending that imminent means I think or someone I delegated thinks that maybe someone could possibly do something at some time? That's an imminent threat that you get to murder somebody over? And then, of course, with Libya, they said it's not a war, it's just a kinetic activity. Oh, yeah, no, it's just a kinetic activity. Get it? Kinetic? Like, the bombs move through the air until they hit their target and explode their target. That's what's kinetic about it. See, the energy that tears human lives apart. Yeah. Anyway, that's why you didn't need any authority from Congress to do a regime change in Libya. For the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, four men who are now flying ISIS flags over Benghazi. And then, as Seymour Hersh documented, all the arms flow. And hey, as Fox News reported, as the Sunday Times reported, Fox News, that's right wing enough for you, isn't it? Where's your talking point on that? Oh, but your talking point on Syria is that Assad is worse than the rebels there, huh, right wingers? So all you have to say about that is what? Benghazi, 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 Benghazi. One day since the regime change, September 11, 2012. That's the only day that anything important happened that you need to know about in Libya. Or the rat line of running all of Gaddafi's guns and the Mujahideen who helped overthrow him up to Syria to fight. Many of whom are veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Many of whom are now fighting with ISIS. How about that for an impeachment scandal? Nobody wants to care about that. Kinetic strikes, they called it. And, of course, the whole thing completely illegal. And just as they've also used the term associated to mean, meh, Kevin Bacon game. This guy knows a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy. And we feel like kidnapping him or killing him or whatever. And that's the rule of law. Eric Holder, literally, I couldn't make this up because you wouldn't believe me. You'd be like, that's stupid. But you're going to believe me now because it's actually true. And you'll believe it now and you'll know it for a fact later when you Google it and double check. The Attorney General gave a speech in Chicago, I think it was Chicago, where he said due process is in the president's mind. He doesn't just conclude, he thinks about it first. He thinks about it and then decides. That's the due process. Stephen Colbert said, see, that's all due process means. It means there is a process that you do, right? Nothing about an indictment or a presentment by a grand jury. Nothing about a trial by a jury of your peers and the right to confront your witnesses against you. Nothing about two witnesses to an overt act for a charge of treason. Nope, Obama just murder you if he feels like it, that's all. He could have tried Alaki in absentia for treason if he had any evidence. Nah, you know what, I'll just murder him, he said. Which is more power than Bush claimed. Bush killed an American in a drone strike in Yemen, but he said, hey, I was targeting the guy driving. And if old boy was riding in the back seat, that's his tough luck. But which was, you know, still criminal, but is a far cry from what Obama did, where he announced to the world, yeah, this guy Alaki, I'm going to murder him the first chance I get. And I don't care if he's an American citizen or not. Put it right in the Washington Post. ACLU and CCR with the grandfather tried to sue to put an injunction and stop him from doing it, which the court denied. How about impeaching him for that? For murder. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I've got Kevin Zeese. He's a lawyer and an anti-war activist. And other kinds of activists, too, I guess. A Bradley Manning, a Chelsea Manning activist. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Scott. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, too. Let's see, comehomeamerica.us, that's one of them. Tell me some more websites where people can look for you.
Well, the major one for me is Popular Resistance, which deals with all the various movements. It's popularresistance.org. If you want to see my legal writing, I'll do a lot of that on the Green Shadow Cabinet, greenshadowcabinet.org.
Where what kind of shadow cabinet again?
Green.
Oh, I got you.
It's an alternative to the existing government.
Got you. All right, greenshadowcabinet.org, that's interesting. Good. Now listen, the reason I brought you on is because you wrote this great thing. It'll be running on antiwar.com tomorrow, and it's all about Edward Snowden and the case against him. And, Hillary Clinton said some things, so let's start with that. What did Hillary Clinton say?
Well, you know, Hillary, she's spouting the national security state line and saying that Snowden should come back and face trial and claiming that he'll have a fair trial and an opportunity to defend himself. She's echoing the comments of the current Secretary of State, John Kerry, who also said Snowden should man up and come back and face prosecution. Of course, the reality is that there is not going to be a fair prosecution if Edward Snowden comes back. It's a rigged deck. It's a really phony trial that he's charged with several charges that would give him 30 years in jail, making him add more to that. And, you know, they're charges under the Espionage Act primarily. And that's an act that, you know, was written in 1917, maybe the eighth prosecution in history under that act, and that President Obama has more than double the number of prosecutions under the Espionage Act than any other president. So we have a history now. We see how these prosecutions go out, and it's not pretty. It does not provide justice to the person accused.
Well, and of course, it's right there in the name of the damn thing that they're lying. Espionage? What espionage? He gave this stuff to the Washington Post. People want to make whatever kind of poster boy out of Greenwald. He gave this stuff to Barton Gellman, who... He's a hard-working reporter, but he's not a controversial reporter. He's a Washington Post... you know, investigative national security beat reporter. He wrote a biography about Dick Cheney that had a lot of great stuff in it, but it wasn't some kind of controversial fringe media, anything kind of thing. This is as official as it gets in American society, and that ain't spying.
No, in fact, both the Washington Post and the Guardian won a Pulitzer Prize for public advocacy because of their coverage of the Snowden documents. So they recognize the Pulitzer Prize, the top journalism award, recognizing that those leaks were done in the public interest. And that's what would not be included in the evidence if Snowden were prosecuted under the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act has become a law. It's just bizarre. It's recent decisions by lower courts, so this has to be upheld by higher courts, and I think it will eventually make its way to the Supreme Court in the Chelsea Manning case. But the key issue is, under lower court decisions, they've decided that the Espionage Act is a strict liability act. So a whistleblower who admits that he released these documents has no defense, because it doesn't matter why he released them. The very fact of releasing them makes him into someone who committed an Espionage Act. The fact that he did it in the public interest, exposed crimes in order to improve the country and make the country work within the law, would be not told to the jury. The jury would not know that. They wouldn't know that Ed Snowden received an award for intelligence integrity from a top former intelligence official in the United States.
It wouldn't even be admissible as testimony at all.
That's right. I mean, none of that would be allowed in the record.
All right. Well, now
listen.
My absurdity is, my specialty is absurdity. So let me do that ad absurdum, as absurd as I can. So what if Edward Snowden had leaked? Because we're talking about, you know, interpretations of 702 or some kind of thing. Let's make it easier. What if he had, documentation that Obama was knowingly using the CIA to, torture, I guess, is de facto legal now. What's illegal? How about smuggling heroin? And he's keeping the profits, him and his old business friends from Chicago. But they're using the CIA to do it, and it's outright criminal. They're in violation of 100 felony criminal statutes. You're telling
example.
Me that if
That's
Edward Snowden leaked that to the Washington Post, that would still be espionage under the court's interpretation of what this law means.
Well, the law basically says if you leak security documents, you are guilty. Now, the question is, would those be national security documents? I don't know if they're, class of heroin smuggling ring led by President Obama would be classified as a national security document or not. But assuming they did somehow classify it that way and someone leaked those documents, that would be espionage under the law.
So maybe if he wasn't keeping the money for himself, but the CIA was spending it on a secret war in Nicaragua or whatever,
that would be sovereign
immunity and nothing really criminal on their part, because they're the government, they decide what's the law. But it would be criminal on his part if he told the truth about
it
to the American
people. Interpretation to have a strict liability offense like this for something as important as essentially treason. I mean, espionage is basically treason, and to have someone strictly liable for that, even if they're releasing documents to expose crimes, to me is just absurd. And then on top of that, we also have all these security state cases, where people have been prosecuted, and you find all sorts of anomalies in the way they go. For example, they're almost always routinely denied bail, despite the Constitution saying you have a right to bail. The due process that they provide is inadequate to provide for a real trial, because a lot of it's conducted in private. The Constitution calls for a public trial, and yet these trials are routinely have large parts kept secret because they claim it undermines national security to have this public trial in these kinds of cases. And then these trials often take place in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is in Alexandria, Virginia, and it includes places like the Pentagon City, Roslyn, Crystal City. These are all areas where massive numbers of weapons contractors, intelligence contractors, security contractors, the Pentagon, the families of all those people, and that's who makes the jury up. So you get this very biased jury. And so it's really it's impossible to have a fair trial. And in the article you mentioned, I compare it to Alice in Wonderland, where in that scene, Lewis Carroll, the court scene, he really mocks the justice system of England as being unfair, and so much of what happens in that Alice in Wonderland trial would apply in the Snowden case. There would be secrets, there would be secret evidence, there would be jurors that are idiots, there would be a court, the protesters would be silenced. Everything that happens in that trial would happen to Snowden. So essentially Hillary Clinton
something.
And John Kerry are saying, hey, Ed Snowden, you should be Alice and get tried in Wonderland.
Well, that's supposed to be a loose metaphor, not a perfect analogy on every point, Kevin, but I guess you got him, man, on this one. God damn.
Well, it's a sad situation. I'm also a member of the Courage Foundation board, And that's a foundation that's devoted to protecting all whistleblowers, as well as protecting our right to know. And the Carter Foundation has its first campaign is to protect Edward Snowden. And you can help out in a couple of ways. You can go to the Carter Foundation and see how you do it. But basically, the two things you can do are, one is you can send a picture of yourself saying that you support Edward Snowden and mentioning your city and some country. Because one thing we're going to be doing is we're going to be approaching those countries to give him a political asylum. When his asylum runs out in Russia, we hope it gets renewed, but we're also looking for alternatives. The second thing, he raised money for his defense because it's an expensive process to get his side of the story out. So check out the Courage Foundation, just like with the Bradley, the Chelsea Manning Support Network, which I'm on the steering committee on. Check out the Courage Foundation and support Edward Snowden. He's done so much to expose such incredible crimes by the government that he deserves our support now. So even if you just send a picture showing your support, that's a big step.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's couragefoundation.org?
Yeah.
Couragefoundation.org. And yeah, you know, back to the... Oh, dang, music's playing. Well, anyway, thanks. I'll let you go. Kevin Zeese, everybody. The great Kevin Zeese. PopularResistance.org, GreenShadowCabinet.org, and CourageFoundation.org. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
We'll be right back, y'all. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, y'all. Oh, good. This is all right. Washington Post. Smallpox discovered sitting in Maryland's storage room. You put the government in charge of your smallpox, huh? Oh, yeah. I'm sure they're going to take real good care of it. Like your mail and your Iraq. Today in smallpox, apparently. A little sarcastic for the Washington Post. Today in smallpox, apparently. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced on Tuesday that employees at the National Institutes of Health found some vials containing smallpox sitting in a laboratory storage room in Bethesda, Maryland. These vials were labeled variola, which the CDC calls the severe and most common form of smallpox. So that's reassuring. Hey, at least they admitted it. No cover-up? Hey, no responsibility, no incentive to cover-up. When no one in government can ever get in trouble for anything that they do to anyone, why not admit it? All right, well, leave it to humans to leave smallpox lying around. I'm assuming this is true at all. It is a news story in the Washington Post, so you never really know, but... Oh, sounded kind of credible. All right, well, anyway. So, this here is my show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Unfortunately, we're not going to be talking with Eric Margolese today because he's just too dang busy. All right, well, anyway, that's all right. I want to say something that belongs in that last interview somewhere right around it. And that is about the absolute and complete unfairness of any kind of federal trial, really at all. And especially on an espionage case. As he said, the only question before the court would be, did Snowden take the documents? Well, that's not in dispute. So, 30 years plus 30 years plus 30 years plus the rest of your life in a cage, pal. When that's the only question before the court. And now, here's the part I want to say, because that's the part that Kevin Z said. Here's the part I want to say. I'm guilty of having this strange fantasy in my head about what a court trial is like. And I've been to court a few times for traffic court, and I've accompanied friends to their, you know, actual in-trouble type trials before. I actually even testified in a felony case one time when I walked in on a Quickie Mart robbery and testified about what I saw that day. But anyway, you know, really my impression of how trials work, mostly comes from TV, from Matlock and Perry Mason, and God forbid from Law and Order, which I admit I have not watched in many, many years. But the premise of all of these things is that at the root, maybe not perfection, but at the root of our court system is truth and fairness. And that's just not true at all. That's really not what it's about. And in fact, if you think about not what you learned from TV, not these pictures, these images in your brain from TV, but what have you ever heard about, I mean, assuming you haven't been in plenty of trouble yourself, what have you heard about the court system from the people around you your whole life long? You know as well as I do. It's all about whether your lawyer knows the judge or not. Oh man, I'm so lucky. My lawyer knows the judge, your friend says. So, whew, they're going to let me do a plea bargain thing. That's what it's always been about. Corruption. Who golfs together? Who's in on it with each other? And, you know, if you think about that movie Tucker, where the whole premise of the movie Tucker, right, is that GM and Ford and Chrysler, they all hire the state to crack down on Tucker, to regulate him out of existence, to sue him on a bunch of trumped up nonsense into bankruptcy. And he goes to defend himself, and the prosecutor says to the judge, "Judge, you know, we object to his soliloquy. So, you know, shut him up on the grounds of, you know, that one case, U.S. versus James from 1930, blah, 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 blah." And the judge is ready to sustain the objection. And an angry juror stands up and says, "Let the man speak. For God's sake, we go through this whole trial. Give the man a chance to defend himself. Go ahead." And then even the judge is like chastened by this juror. Wow. Here in America, you just can't get away with railroading somebody that bad, right? In America right now, the SWAT team would put a bullet right through that juror's heart for standing up and yelling like that, probably. "Bailiff, kill him!" But in the movie Tucker, the juror says, "Your Honor, don't sustain that objection. Damn it, let the man answer. Let him tell his side of the story." And that's the American criminal justice system we believe in. That's the one that we're taught about in elementary school. That's the one that we see on TV. Where before the guy gets the, you know, clamps put on him and taken away to the hole for the rest of his life, he gets a fair shot of telling his side of the story. Right? No. Not right. TV is lying to you about how much these people care about the truth. And again, forget TV. Go with what you know, what you have known your whole life. How old were you? Do you have a guess how old you were the first time that you ever heard of a conviction rate for a prosecutor, and how important it is for a prosecutor that his conviction rate remains high, and how you thought at the time that's kind of in conflict with just making sure you're really right every time, which sometimes the cops will get it wrong, right? So then who wins, the conviction rate or the truth? You've known your whole life that that's how it is, whether your lawyer is friends with the judge, whether the prosecutor is having a good day or a bad one, whether they care at all whether you did the thing you're being accused of. As I've repeated a million times on the air, the Harris County, that's Houston, district attorney said to me, the slogan at the DA's office in Houston is, if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. Which, of course, is a lie. The only way you get out on appeal is the burden of proof is on you to prove that something was manifestly unjust about your trial, like your lawyer was drunk and slept through the whole thing, or the prosecutor and the judge had a secret deal and it's proven in emails, or some kind of thing. The judge outright ignored court precedent and allowed evidence that shouldn't have been allowed, or, you know, something really substantial. Otherwise, you can rot. Finality is very important to the state, you understand. What credibility would the judges have if every criminal case heard in their court gets overturned due to their criminality all the time. None, so they rather let innocence rot. In other words, Hillary Clinton and John Kerry are both a couple of damned liars. Anyone who says anything like, well, that Ed Snowden, if he's a real man, ought to come and face the music and whatever, is either a liar or a damned fool who believes and then regurgitates the slogans of liars. Ed Snowden comes home without a deal signed in concrete. He goes to prison. That's it. He will not be able to get up in front of the court and have his say. Your Honor, as Kevin Zeese just outlined, Your Honor, the newspapers I leaked to won Pulitzer Prizes for the work. The Director of Intelligence agreed that the conversation I started needed to happen. Etc., 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 etc. The people of America have, even the president has said he welcomes the debate caused by the leak, and that it was, and that he agreed that the bulk collection had gone too far, and etc., 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 which proves, Your Honor, the necessity that I leak. Oh, and by the way, we're not talking about low-level crimes by, you know, analysts at the NSA. We're talking about the head of the NSA and the FISA court and the president and the Congress. They are all doing something wrong. They need to be told on to the real boss, the American people. So it's not a matter of, oh, they're, you know, four analysts, Bobby, Joe, Susie, and Larry, are all deliberately misinterpreting Section 702 to get away with a little something something to transfer some dollars to their bank account or to spy on their ex-spouse or whatever. No, no, no. We're talking about the government itself, the entire policy, unconstitutional, out of control. He would not be able to say that in court. He would not even be able to try it. So you see, America is a totalitarian dictatorship with nothing like a rule of law, nothing like fair trials like on Matlock. If those days ever existed, they're dead now. Certainly on a case like this. Where the prosecutor's happy to concede, gee, I guess you're right, Matlock. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. And anyway, one more thing about Snowden that Kevin Zeese was saying that's worth emphasizing. Obama has prosecuted more leakers under the Espionage Act, which again is an outright lie that they're committing espionage. It's just a lie. In none of these cases is it actually espionage, spying on behalf of a foreign power at all. But he has charged more cases under the Espionage Act than all the presidents since Woodrow Wilson signed the damn thing into law 100 years ago. More than twice as many as all the other presidents' Espionage Act prosecutions combined. He is a lawless madman. That's a great reason for impeaching him right there. That's a high crime right there. Oh yeah, that was already on my list earlier, wasn't it? Pretending that whistleblowing is espionage. Bastard. Anyway. Okay, so I guess I need to move on to some more stuff. Let's talk about Iraq. ISIS rounds up ex-Baathists as rivals in Mosul, working on consolidating their power. This is, it's a very interesting thing to me. Just to see, I mean, obviously, the overriding thing here is stay the hell out of this war from now on. But it's also just interesting to see how it's playing out with these guys. I mean, the leader is from Iraq. They say he's from Samarra. So, It's not like he's just a foreigner here. But then again, ISIS is, it's kind of a riddle. ISIS is a pretty small number of guys, maybe as many as 10,000 now. They've recruited a lot more. They're certainly not the kind of super majority. They don't represent the super majority point of view of the so-called Sunni triangle, or the Anbar and other whatever, the northwestern provinces, North Anbar, I don't know what they're all called. Anyway, up where Mosul is and all that, toward Kurdistan. But they have the power right now. They have the momentum right now. And so they know what a precarious position that they're in. If they're going to declare an Islamic State, they're going to make that a real thing as fast as they can. And as real as they can, in as many ways as they can. And one thing to do will be to look for potential rivals, like former Ba'athist generals and top-level party leaders, and cut their heads off. They have now said, you either swear allegiance to us or disarm. But if you think you're going to keep your weapons and not be loyal to us, we're going to kill you. That's the official position of the Islamic State. And so they're going around abducting ex-Ba'athist generals. And it says here, some pledge allegiance, those who don't believe, those they don't believe will pledge allegiance, they will execute, said Shiite parliamentarian hater Abadi. And by the way, Patrick Coburn had a new piece out that came out, last night. It was Patrick Coburn's new one. In fact, it's got to be on antiwar.com right now, where he says, let me see if it's on here. Dun, 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 dun. Is it this one? Yeah, here we go. Coburn. ISIS leader preaches holy war as his forces move on Baghdad. So the point of this that I want to highlight here, let me see if I can find it and get the quote right for you. Anyway, he says, ISIS's obsession with killing Shiites, with scapegoating and targeting Shiites as enemies for extinction, parallels the Shiites, he says, fill the same role that Jews filled for the fascists of Europe in the 30s. These guys are the most, chauvinist on the you can't be a Shia issue. I guess my point being, Coburn seems to prioritize this in his, you know, description of who these guys are much more than other writers and journalists on this issue. I think that these guys are absolutely obsessed with killing Shia. And so, that may well be their undoing. They're outnumbered in Iraq, that's for sure. But then again, there's no real organized force in Iraq to fight them either. I admit I was a little bit astounded when, I already know this, but I guess that interview with Mitchell Prothero yesterday really drove it home that, listen, the Iraqi army did not just withdraw from Mosul and all those Sunni provinces and fall back to Iraq. It basically just completely fell apart. There really is no Iraqi army. When Sistani said, hey, young Shia fighting age males, that's the supreme, highest ranking Shia Islamic leader. When he said, fighting age males, Shia, go join the army. There's no army for him to join. The whole thing is such a joke. Is such a corrupt nightmare. There really is no army. And there's no political leader who could rally it back together. You know who's the army? The Bada Brigade. And the Mahdi Army. And what's it called? Al-Haq. I forgot the beginning part. One of the sort of breakoffs from the Sadrists. Iranian-backed so-called special groups. That entire project, we can't leave now in 2005. We can't leave now. We'll stand down when they stand up. They'll stand up, we'll stand down. That's what Bush said. I actually have that speech here somewhere. George Bush, December 2005. The strategy for victory. We can't leave now. We got to train up the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army that was pushed over with one finger by guys in pickup trucks. Whole damn thing fell apart. I guess somewhere in my mind I imagined that it still existed at least in Baghdad, or at least in Basra, at least in safe Shiite territory. No. Not so much. The entire army building project over there, a joke. There are, as Coburn and Prothero both said, there are special forces groups. The Wolf Brigade, which is just, you know, the leaders of the old Bada Brigade. There are SWAT teams and there are special forces units that are well trained and paid and equipped that are loyal directly, or at least work directly for Maliki. And that's about it for the army. Oh, and by the way, did you see the one the other day? It didn't get much press, not even here, but I saw it. It was in my brain somewhere. I just never got to it, I guess. I don't know, but Maliki fired his two highest military leaders and appointed his son in their place. His son and I guess his son's best friend. Or maybe Maliki's best friend. I forgot whose best friend he was. But so this goes to show what's Maliki's real concern right now is not taking back Mosul. It's surviving a military coup. There is no force in parliament powerful enough to depose him. No coalition, no leader coming forward that people can rally behind. Not Chalabi, not Alawi, not Al-Mahdi. Who's going to be the new leader? It's going to be a general. If anything, it's going to be a coup. It's not going to be a vote in the parliament. It'll be an end of the Islamic Republic of Iraq, and it'll just be the Shiite military dictatorship of Iraq. Southern Shiistan. Maybe with Muqtada finally as the Ayatollah at the end. Why not? I don't know if he has that ambition, but if he really does, he could be. Wouldn't that be something? Remember when they lynched Saddam Hussein in that barn, what the men chanted? Muqtada, Muqtada, Muqtada. The nation formerly known as Iraq. More in a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. You know, really, this is every segment of this show should just be the same damn thing. Listen, we got to stay out of this latest part of the Iraq war. ISIS is dangerous if we provoke them. Right now, they have local concerns that they're focused on. There is no reason to make whatever bad happens to them America's quote-unquote fault. Our government's fault. Just stay out of it. I mean, the whole, obviously, American foreign policy from Jimmy Carter on, really from Eisenhower on, has helped lead to this. We've been bombing and bombing and picking on Iraq nonstop. I mean, when Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan backed Saddam, they were getting him into real trouble, a real serious war with Iran that killed 500,000 Iraqis and 500,000 Iranians, too. It was a catastrophe. And that was when they were backing him. And, of course, during that same time, that was when he did the Anfal campaign, which killed 100 or 200,000 Kurds, now I forget. And all that. And then ever since 1990, America's had them under sanctions and bombings. And the first Gulf War killed hundreds of thousands, well, 100,000 people, something like that, directly. And then they targeted the waterworks, the electricity, the very infrastructure, the roads, everything, the civilian economy of the country, and kept the country under blockade and starved about 1 million people to death, half of them children. which Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, happily admitted to. Wasn't really a controversy back when she said this on 60 Minutes.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
And so, been bombed, and that was just in the 90s. That was during peacetime. Jerry Seinfeld and Crystal Pepsi and dot-com bubble, and everything is fine. A million. And then, of course, the Bush administration completely destroying the entire society. Not just did he fight a giant war to put the Shiites in power in Baghdad, which took the deaths of, you know, upwards of a million people to accomplish, but also just completely decimated the Assyrian and Chaldean Christian, Jewish, Druish, Turkmen, and Yazidi, and all the other ethnic and cultural and religious minorities who had found safe haven in Iraq for thousands of years. Christians have lived in Iraq for 2,000 years. And George Bush's war got them all kicked out. They're living in refugee camps up in Kurdistan, or it used to be Syria if they were lucky. Now Kurdistan if they're lucky. Since America's helped to destroy Syria too. And this is what Patrick Coburn always emphasizes every time. He says, don't, you know, neglect to give me an opportunity to mention that America's policy against Assad in Syria since 2011 has helped lead to this entire crisis too. People say it's Barack Obama's fault for pulling out of Iraq. It's Barack Obama's fault for reversing the Iraq policy and fighting on the side of the Sunni-based insurgency against the Shiite government in charge in Damascus. Richard Pearl in that clip talks about, Obama's refusal to get involved in Syria on the side of the moderates has led for more extreme elements to come to the fore. What moderates? There never were enough so-called moderates to put together into any kind of real army. They tried it. It didn't work. That's why they quit trying it. Also, it blew up in their face in Libya when they realized that, yeah, these jihadists will turn on you and kill you if they feel like it. You can use them, but that doesn't mean that you control their every activity. You'd think they'd have learned that by now. So they got their ambassador killed there, working with these jihadists and running Gaddafi's guns up there to Syria. But Coburn has been saying on this show, and if you're not familiar, Patrick Coburn is the best Western reporter in the Middle East, writes for The Independent, and he was saying the whole time, listen, America's insistence that Assad go, that the rebels don't have to deal with him, that there should not be a peaceful solution soon, that the war should continue, that weapons and money should keep going to these so-called moderates and keep ending up in the hands of the so-called extremists. This policy has helped to energize the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq that already has had their own reasons to hate Maliki for a long time now. And this is making them think, wait a minute, why do we lose Baghdad again? Maybe the Shia are the majority in Iraq, but they sure as hell are the minority in Islam, and they're the minority among Arabs. Why should the Sunnis sit back and take this, especially when they're having so much success in splitting off half of Syria from the control of Assad? And so the Sunni-based insurgency, which had been, you know, at least quelled and tamped down in Iraq, was, you know, it was like blowing oxygen straight on the flame in Syria. And now that border doesn't even exist anymore. It's the same Sunni-based insurgency on both sides of the former border there. And I think Mitchell Prothero is right. I do not think that it's too soon to start talking about, yeah, the Islamic State as a real place. Iraq is over. Maybe you can call the rump of Syria will still be called Syria now. I mean, it's true that Assad, you know, never has been losing this war. But on the other hand, he's basically ceded the entire eastern countryside. He controls all the major cities. He controls the coast, at least. But they're doing pretty good in dismembering and at least running off with the eastern part of the country, including some oil wells and I don't know, a handful of towns and cities, including Raqqa. I guess that's the only city they control. But who can ever put Iraq back together again when the Kurds have taken the opportunity to go ahead and lock down Kurdistan and announce they're keeping it to make all their own, to no longer pretend they're ever going to work with the Baghdad government on their oil deals ever again. They're already spinning off. They've got a referendum coming up. The Kurds are done. The Kurds are done with the central government in Baghdad, no matter how this shakes out. And when the Islamic State has declared its independence from Baghdad and proven it, who's going to do anything about it? You would have to have Obama and Khamenei go full scale to war on behalf of the Shia again to try to conquer the Anbar province and the Sunni triangle again. The American people aren't for it. Now, maybe they could, you know, I don't know. See, it's still a while before Hillary or Jeb comes. And of course, you know, it's easy to say if it's Hillary or Jeb, the carpet bombing will begin on January 21st of 2017. But can Obama hold out that long? I don't think so. I mean, and I don't mean to imply, you know, intelligence or decency of any kind onto the president. You know, maybe whatever's the worst idea is his best idea. But he does seem to be somewhat hesitant so far. He sent some drones and some helicopters, but they don't seem to be doing very much so far. They're going to outright fly air support for the Revolutionary Guard on the ground, the Iranian Special Forces? Seems to me like it's already a fait accompli. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. A little bit of domestic empire for you here. The drug war and the police state at home. It seems like we could begin to roll the police state back now instead of just letting it get worse and worse and worse until we're all dead. Does that seem fair enough, like a strategy that we just ought to try to start caring about this stuff and prioritizing the police state as a political issue? I mean, hey, I don't know. What if your state representative said, hey, I'm really worried about all this militarization of the police, and you elect me, and I mean, and I'm serious, I'm going to roll it back, you watch. Would you support somebody like that? Is there a single state representative in your state who thinks that he better talk like that if he wants to win? What do we, the people of America, have to do? And look, I mean, obviously, it's all vested interests. All the arms manufacturers that sell to the cops, that's a huge interest group. All the police unions, oh my God. Those guys are worse than the Soviet Union. Those guys are the worst organization. They're worse than Pol Pot. Goddamn police unions. We're up against a huge thing. What we need is a huge consensus. What we need is just forget about it. The fools to the left of me, the jokers to the right, everybody agrees. Enough of this drug war, enough of this domestic spying, enough of the militarization of our local sheriff's department. I mean, hell, Americans even agree now that it was wrong to kill all those Fallujans. A mistake, they call it. Never should have done it. Well, then how in the world could it be the right thing to let our local police treat us like we're the Fallujans? And they can just do their Delta Force night raids and kick in our doors and kill us like we're some foreign enemy when we're the ones they're supposedly sworn to protect. It's completely out of control. And you know it, and I know it, and everybody knows it. So how about, hey, come on now, enough then. Radley Balco at the Washington Post, and, you know, thank Jesus or whoever for the miracle that Radley Balco was allowed somehow to write the things that he writes at the Washington Post. And I don't know if they even publish them in the paper, but the fact that he's on their website, you know, doing journalism like this, this is huge. This is real progress. You know, it could be capitalized on. But he's got one here. Meet Jason Westcott. Your latest needless, inexcusable drug war casualty. Tampa Bay, Florida. Human being named Jason Westcott shot to death in his home by the SWAT team in the middle of the night. Well, it must be his fault, right? He pointed a gun at him, right? Right. He pointed a gun at him. They were breaking into his house in the middle of the night. But it's worse than that. He'd had a party, and someone had threatened him. I'm going to come back here and kill you, man, kind of a thing. He called the cops. The cops told him, somebody comes in your house, breaks down your door trying to kill you. You shoot and kill them. That's your right. Which is, of course, correct. And is the law. And so then the cops, the same ones who gave him that advice, the same department, the SWAT team of that same department, came and kicked in his door in the middle of the night. So he grabbed his gun, he pointed at them, and they killed him. They killed him, now he's dead. And the cops' only attitude is, hey, he pointed a gun at us, man. Oh no, they couldn't concede, right? They're like, George Bush refusing to fire Doug Feith. There's no way they're going to admit that anything wrong has happened here. No way they're going to go back and revisit the question of what in the hell they were doing in this man's house in the first place. They were defending themselves when they were the aggressors. He was attempting to defend himself. Fell short, fell dead. And why? Because the cops say an informant said that he bought some weed from this guy. How much did they find? Basically nothing. I mean, it says in this report $2 worth of pot was found in the guy's house. So, stems and seeds. $2 worth of pot. As Balco talks about here, it's clear that they either did no real kind of investigation or they did and they knew better, but they just didn't care. They raided on the night when he typically is watching the kids, separated from his wife, but I believe that was the story. This is the night that he usually has the kids. And that was the night that they raided. It was only luck that they weren't there to also be murdered by the cops or to see their father murdered for nothing in front of their eyes. And this guy wasn't just some plain old human like an Iraqi or a Somali. He was an extra special, exceptional American human, you know, with rights and everything. And the cops murdered him. And you know why they did it. You know why already. Because they know they can never get in trouble for it. Ever, ever. And so why not? Think about the thrill. From the point of view of one of these steroid-pumping meathead murderer SWAT cops. Hiding in cowardly terror between his, you know, 2 feet plated, 2 feet thick plated armor. And all his stormtrooper gear, all his Kevlar. The thrill of breaking down an American's door and killing him in the middle of the night. Oh, what fun. 2 weeks paid vacation while they do their perfunctory investigation. And you know what? Even if it was some kind of mistake, that's okay. He's got sovereign immunity. You know, like the King of England. And I don't know, what if I say, hey, this guy was a rich white golfer? Then is he human enough that it counts? Or how about he was a liberal college professor? How about now? Now is he human enough? How about he was a cable TV news hairdo? Oh my God! They murdered, the SWAT team murdered a cable TV news anchor, everyone. Now does his life count enough for anybody else to care? For anything to be done? For anyone to take the Heckler & Koch MP5 machine guns away from these cops? Put them back in blouses and put them back out on traffic control? Instead of kicking in people's doors in the middle of the night and murdering them under the excuse of $2, $2,014 worth of pot? What insanity is this? You know, it reminds me, it's almost like, you know, the people with the just most outlandish kind of cultish religion. End times, you know, the end of the world is this May 21st or whatever. Remember that? This kind of thing where, or the Mayan calendar or whatever. Doesn't matter how wrong it is. Just keep believing in it as hard as you can. Just someday the SWAT teams of America will murder enough of us that just people quit using drugs. Or, I don't know, the police union's bloodlust will finally be satisfied. Someday, real soon. Right? Drug-free America, coming this way. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. See, this is what I'm trying to tell you. There's no such thing as the law. Cops can kill you if they want. Right here, California deputy who shot teen, who killed teen with a toy gun. Not killed him with a toy gun, killed the teen with a toy gun. Won't face charges. No, of course he won't. He has sovereign immunity. A meter maid could torture you to death, and as long as they did it on the clock, sovereign immunity. A school teacher could rape your kid, sovereign immunity. A cop could murder every black man in your neighborhood, sovereign immunity. Round them up and kill them. Hey, judge, I was on the clock, sovereign immunity, no bill. Kill whoever you want. That's what every cop is told his first day of training. Listen, you can kill whoever you want. You'll never get in trouble. Now go out there and get them, Tiger. Go out there and murder some Americans for fun because there's nothing that can stop you. You want to be a murderer and you got an IQ higher than 100, you ought to be smart enough to figure out to go get a job working for the government. Where you have sovereign immunity, where you can kill whoever you want. You can shoot a 13-year-old boy with a toy gun and say, yeah, what? I'm a cop. I own you. I'll kill you too. And they'll no-bill you. That's it. Sovereign immunity. They can murder any of us that they feel like. Law? There's no such thing as law. You might as well be a Palestinian on the occupied West Bank right now. And the Shin Bet can torture your kid. They can kill you. They can kill your mom or your little sister and never, ever, ever be held accountable. That's the rule of law in the United States of America. 2 million people in prison right now. So-called libertarians calling for soldiers on the border to just make it that much worse. And by the way, it doesn't matter, right, that the border is now 100 miles inland from any border. Meaning more than two-thirds supermajority population of the United States already lives in a constitution-free zone when it comes to federal border police jurisdiction. Oh no, we haven't gone nearly far enough. These guys, right now, there's McClatchy newspapers again. Hey, I get their morning email. What can I do? They do good journalism. The Border Patrol now, ICE, under Homeland Security, they have an Inspector General investigation going on right now for all the people that they kill for no reason down there on the border. They're the ones that you never hear about. Oh, look, a Mexican walking in the desert. Aim for his head, right? That's official Border Patrol policy. Go ahead and shoot to kill. Like you're hunting at a Dick Cheney canned hunt somewhere. That's the rule of law in America. Where all smart murderers get a job as a cop first and then murder anyone they feel like. Ooh, 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 I want to be on the SWAT team. Oh, I mean, not that I want to murder anybody or anything, but it'd be fun to almost murder somebody all the time, you know? That's what they say. And then in training, they say, welcome to police training, maggot. You are now the Ubermenschen. The American public are the enemy, and you can murder any of them that you want and never, ever, 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 ever get in trouble. Now, for a field trip, we're going to go to Fort Hood and learn from the Army Delta Force how to murder American citizens in their own homes on the accusation that they might have $2,014 worth of pot. Look, a little boy walking down the street with a plastic gun. Kill him. Hey, that's a good enough excuse. I'll be able to claim later that I thought it was a real gun. So there you go. Aim for his heart. Take his 13-year-old life away. It's all right. You have sovereign immunity. There's no such thing as law in America. Not now, not ever. The government, they're the ones who the law does not apply to. At all. They wonder in the polls of the liberals on Twitter. You should see the angst of the liberals on Twitter over the lack of public confidence in the government. Oh my God, without the government to hold us together, society could rip itself apart. Yeah, well, maybe we hate your government. Maybe we're tired of you sicking the stormtroopers of death on us to enforce your every public policy whim. Maybe the government is guilty, and that's why the good people of America hate it. And the people who enforce its dictates. We're not the criminals. The government, they're the lawless ones. They're the victimizers around here. It's plain as day for all to see. Our society would be, I don't know, 50% less violent immediately if we just abolish the government altogether. Security force, they're the most destabilizing, violent force in our society. Plain as day. Read some Lou Rockwell's new book or whatever if you don't get it yet. Absolutely out of control. Anyway, and those are just, you know, listen to me. That's just two stories from Rally Balco in one day. One from Twitter, one from the Post. These guys get away with whatever they want. It's amazing that they let him write in the Washington Post, isn't it? And I know he's not as radical as me. He says, no, cops are okay, but this is the problem. Fine. I'll take a radical minarchist any day. There's a guy who's getting work done in raising awareness of this issue. And I guess, you know, I've always just imagined that, you know what, we're just going to live in an absolute, you know, totalitarian nightmare where the sun never comes out, man. We're just complete and total technological slaves of the national government for the next 1,000 years. And it's going to be like 1984 and Terminator and everything worse all rolled into one. Name your dystopia. That's where we're going. But wait, is it possible that we really could use the old law to somehow restrict the way that the technology of complete control is deployed against us? Is there even a chance of it? Should we try it? Balco points out that the ACLU put out this giant new report, and it got a lot of attention. Not from alternative media, but kind of from everybody. The silver lining in the horror of the government's terrorism against that little boy in Atlanta when they threw the grenade into his crib is that there's just no way. It doesn't matter if he, you know, what color he is or anything else. I mean, there's just no way you can spin that as somehow anybody's fault but the cop who threw the grenade. And they tried. They tried to say that a guy who was accused of selling a dime bag worth of meth out of that house was the terrorist responsible for this. But no, it was the SWAT team. Everybody knows it was the SWAT team. You know, the guys that threw the grenade. Sort of like if somebody threw a grenade at the SWAT team, there wouldn't be much question about who was responsible. The guy who threw the grenade. In this case, they threw it at a toddler, a two-year-old little boy. And blew his face off, blew a giant hole in his chest. And he's out of his medically induced coma now, but is in still, I don't know if intensive care, but is still in serious treatment in the hospital. And people are taking note of this. You have kind of a confluence of stories. And, you know, I don't know what it takes. What does it take to get a consensus that, hey, we don't want this? We want our cops to wear blouses, not military fatigues. And we want them to carry 38 revolvers, not M16s. We want their patrol cars to be white. And we want their attitude to be nice. And that'll be a nice start. Sorry to say nice twice right there. I don't know what the hell I'm doing here with the rhetoric, but I'm just trying to be right. That's all. Enough of this. We want, speaking of Matlock, we want fair trials like Matlock, and we want honest, nice, peacekeeping deputy sheriffs like on the Andy Griffith Show. That's what we want. You know, because we're exceptional. Because we believe in freedom and we mean to keep it, right? What's the holdup here? What right-winger or left-winger has got an argument against this? What Democrat or Republican, other than, you know, again, the people who sell the guns directly to the police unions, the iron bar and concrete companies that like building prisons, Ford, for all the, I guess they don't do Crown Vicks anymore, whoever's doing all the cop cars now, are they doing Chryslers now? Other than the vested interest, who wants a militarized Iraq war at home from now on? I know, me either. So let's get it together.